The Guardian.
Hello and welcome back to the last of three Science Weekly extras dedicated to the scientific, technological and social changes needed to sustain the global supply of food, water and energy. Hosted by Joe Confino, executive editor of The Guardian and director of Guardian Sustainability, an expert panel discussed the entwined relationships, the nexus, between these three vital natural resources, food, water and energy. This final debate looks at how water and energy are connected. It was originally live-streamed on guardian.co.uk in February of 2013, and it is brought to you in association with the brewer S.A.B. Miller.
Hello and welcome back to the third and final Guardian Nexus debate in association with S.A.B. Miller. The last session, we looked at the whole issue of water and food for energy, which is actually a reasonably well-known concept, but something that's much less known, but just as important, is the whole issue of enormous amounts of water energy we need to actually move, filter and pressurise our water supplies. So we're going to be looking at that part of the nexus in the next 45 minutes. We've got a fantastic panel lineup. We've got Gerard Payan, president of Aquafed, which represents the world's private water companies. We've got Usha Romanari, director of sustainable business at the International Finance Corporation. And finally, we've got Jens Beglen, who's director of the Stockholm Water Prize. What we asked each of the panelists to do was to pick one area of this subject that they think is significant and to then talk about it. So, Gerard, we're going to start with you. Those who've watched the previous two, you'll see that we used silver envelopes, but we've definitely gone one stage further and we're using gold envelopes this time. So, Gerard, would you like to open your envelope, hold up your piece of paper, and show us what issue you brought? No power equals no water. Why that?
Well, my job and the job of Aquafed's member is to bring good quality water to people and to clean the water they have to use. And for us, power is absolutely essential. Out of the 4 billion people who have water at home on this planet, only a minority can benefit from water that flows easily to them because the source is at a higher altitude. It comes from a mountain, for example. But the vast majority of people live in areas or in buildings where the altitude is higher than the river or the underground aquifer where the water comes from. This means that for them having water at home, it is necessary to pump the water with an electrical pump. This requires a lot of electrical power. But this is not sufficient. They need good quality water. They need purified water. And the treatment of water in order that it is safe requires also a lot of energy. So for people having water at home, we need energy. I would like to highlight two consequences of that. In countries like the UK or the US, where everybody has access to water, there are, from time to time, exceptional events. In New York recently, for example, when you have a huge storm or huge snowfall or disaster like an earthquake, the power supply is immediately disrupted, which means that the water supply is also disrupted. And this can last for days unless the water operator can perform a miracle. This can happen. I can provide examples if you like, but it's not so easy. The other consequence I would like to highlight is for developing countries. Unfortunately, in many areas in developing countries, the power supply is discontinuous and unreliable. So I know many cities where the water operators cannot pump the water because the power is not there. This is a severe nuisance for the population because it's not only an inconvenience, they don't have water at home, but in addition, the water, the good quality water that was introduced in the pipes by the operator in a water treatment plant, can get contaminated by water coming from the soil. When the pumps stop, the pressure drops in the pipes, so it is easy for water coming from the outside to infiltrate into the pipe. The result is the water that comes at your pipe is unsafe. So no power means for us no water and potential contamination. This explains why operators pay a lot of attention to the reliability of
power supply. Okay, so that's the problem, but we all know that there's issues of energy supply are likely to get worse. And also, what can be done about it? So that's the problem. What can you do about it? What needs to be done? What's the challenge?
Well, we rely on power supply and power services. Fortunately, they are improving everywhere in the world, fortunately. But in many cases, water supply operators have to organize alternative sources of power. This is costly, but it is necessary. I remember, for example, in the southwest of France a few years ago, there was a huge storm that damaged thousands of trees and cut numerous power lines. So the power supply was cut for a week for thousands, for hundreds of thousands of people. But after 2 days, everybody got water supply again because the different water operators moved mobile power generators from all over France and even from Spain, you know, to move the water.
So, but how are we going to reduce energy consumption for water? Because you say, you know, that's the fact, but actually one of the things we need to do is actually lower energy levels needed for water. How are we going to do that?
Well, that's the job of water operators. They do that every day, trying to optimize the consumption of water in the pipes. This can be done through the management of the pressure in the pipes. The pressure can vary during the hours of the day. And there are also options for improving the energy consumption in the treatment of water, in the purification treatment. There are several technologies, and fortunately, there are improvements every year in the energy consumption of each technology. There are significant improvements. However, for similar conditions, operators are able to improve, to make improvements. But over the long term, we have to accept the fact that there will be more energy used for water supply.
Okay.
For a variety of reasons.
Okay. Jens, what in terms of existing water supply, I mean, in terms of reusing water, I mean, how significant a factor is that rather than just taking water out of the sort of watersheds or out of the rivers? What's the role of water reuse?
I think water reuse, it's used in many cases, and depending, of course, on where you are in the world. I remember somebody telling me that in the bars in Namibia, there's actually a sign saying you don't buy a beer, you borrow it, because they have to recycle all the water from sort of the wastewater. It gets treated and then it's actually fed back into the system. But that is, of course, in extreme cases where there are extreme water scarcity. In other places, water is reused not for drinking purposes, but it's slightly treated and then used again in agriculture for agricultural purposes and other sort of less, with less demands on quality. So there are different options that could be used. But one thing that could, also, of course, also be used to save the energy consumption of the water sector is, I mean, we use energy for transporting and for treating water. And if you don't pollute the water in the first place or have a clean source, that is a good way of not having to treat it. In Stockholm, about 100 years ago, was one of the dirtiest cities in the world. In the 1970s, it was still extremely dirty. Today, the water in Lake Mälaren is actually so clean you can almost drink it directly. There's just a minimal treatment there. So that didn't take a lot of fossil energy. It took a lot of human energy to invest in changing behaviors so that people don't put the wrong things in the water in the first place, and then hence avoiding the costly or energy-intensive treatment that could be needed in other places. So there are ways of getting around this. And for transporting water, one way has been tried in several places in the world is rainwater harvesting. Instead of moving water over large distances to supply in a booming urban area, you can actually collect the water that comes as rainfall, which would reduce the risks for droughts like the ones in New York. I don't think that could have maybe been saved by rainwater harvesting, but they have systems there where they've actually made flower beds far deeper and having flower beds in certain areas that can work as a retention area when there's heavy rainfall to save the city from flooding. And also you might not have to water those flower beds if you have plenty of water in the depth, so to say. So there are issues you can work with like that.
Okay, thank you. Usha, I mean, if you look at the data, they say within 17 years there's going to be a 30% excess demand compared with the supply. So, I mean, we're not talking about a minor issue, we're talking about actually an incredibly important issue for hundreds of millions of people around the world. Mm-hmm. What do you see as the key ways of solving that crisis?
For me, it's all the delivery model, really. So Gerard talked about how to get efficiencies in consumption of energy in the delivery of water. You spoke about transporting it over smaller distances.
And I think that's your...
And that is basically my... But here's the thing. Yeah. So far, historically in the world, we're used to very centralized water distribution systems or water delivery systems, large networks which take water from a certain point and then deliver it to other points, which is all very, very energy intensive. As we go into the future, and certainly we are looking at several models of water delivery, which is more point of use or even point of source, where actually the water is collected and treated and delivered at one source, and that is definitely less water energy intensive than the historical sort of centralized network model.
Okay, and just for the record, you can't get away from getting it out of the energy, you still need to show us it.
So my topic is delivery. And I actually think this is probably one of the fundamental issues in the water sector. Historically, access to clean and safe water has been an overriding issue that everybody has faced in the water sector. And the poorer the country, really, the bigger the issue. And access is all about delivery. How are you going to get the water to the largest number of people in the shortest period of time, really, and in the cleanest possible way? A large part of that equation is infrastructure. And so historically, as I mentioned, people have relied on large and capital-intensive infrastructure systems to deliver water. Why? Because we had to make sure it was safe, we had to make sure it was clean, we had to make sure it was timely, as Gerard was correctly saying. However, the cost is enormous. The cost of putting down such infrastructure into the ground is enormous, and now, with increasing urbanization and increasing density of populations in many, many population areas, it's becoming very difficult to set down a centralized network system. So people are looking at alternative delivery models on the one hand, as I said, point of use, point of source, as well as alternative energy sources. I mean, can you have an energy source that you don't have to connect up to a large transmission grid somewhere, which again uses that much more energy than you had started with and that much more capital-intensive infrastructure? So we're looking, for example, at solar-powered point-of-use systems. There's a small project in Haiti that's starting up now that's looking at exactly that. Private sector company is looking at putting in place small kiosks that are powered by the sun to treat water that's collected from a nearby source. It's just very interesting, and it is going against traditional thought and traditional doctrine, really, in terms of water delivery, because people are finding you can serve an increasingly remote population through decentralized delivery models.
Right. So, Gerard, aren't your water companies therefore a problem? Because you know, water companies tend to be large, they tend to be centralized, and what we're saying is actually some of the answers are going to be decentralized. How are you going to cope with that?
Because you have a wrong image of water companies.
Right, so
that's the only answer.
Clean up my image.
I mean, water companies are of all sizes. They are large companies, even multinational companies, but most of them are small.
Great.
We have members that operate water systems that supply hundreds or thousands of people only.
Okay.
And even a large company is able to handle several decentralized systems.
So then tell me what Usha says. How can water companies actually focus more on local solutions as well as much bigger solutions? I mean, how do you get that balance right?
Well, their job is to act as a government agent, providing the best solutions. So they have a real incentive to provide optimization of the cost. And part of this optimization comes from energy cost. I could provide examples. In Bucharest, for example, in 10 years, the cost of the energy consumption has been reduced by 75%. In Macau, in 7 years, it was decreased by one-third. So it is normal. It is a normal job to reduce the cost of energy consumption. It could be through centralized system or decentralized system. This is a completely different story, in my view.
Okay. Jens, what is the role of ecological solutions? Because a lot of people, when I ask for examples, they talk about New York. That they worked with the farmers and everyone upstream to actually clean the water so that when it came actually down into New York, it didn't actually have to be treated, and therefore it saved enormous amounts of energy. Are we getting too stuck in technological solutions rather than in ecological solutions?
I don't know, to be honest with you. Both things are happening simultaneously. And I know that sort of in many cases, people are protecting the environment to protect the water source. I mean, if you have a good environment, if you're able to discuss with farmers so that they use fertilizers and pesticides in such a way that doesn't really affect the water quality in different ways, that would also save sort of treatment costs and also have a good water source. There are also cases where there's been evaluations of the ecological services that are provided by, for example, wetlands. So in Kampala in Uganda, they made a study looking at the wetland right outside the city, sort of on the border to Lake Victoria. And the value of that wetland for the treatment that it sort of does for the population was estimated some, I think it was $1 billion. So the cost to sort of, if you were to get rid of that wetland for any purposes, you would have to build a treatment plant for about $1 million. So there are those sort of, what you call them, there are movements in both directions. I mean, people who want to see their, be seen as the ones building something for the political economy, I have put a treatment plant in place, they would like to see the concrete. Whereas there's a bigger, I would say, environmental movement who are talking about green infrastructure as opposed to sort of the grey infrastructure that comes with concrete.
Great. Yeah. Usha.
No, I think, you know, he sort of mentioned that. I thought I heard you try to distinguish between technological and ecological.
Well, I'm
and
wondering, I'm saying that is a natural distinction, actually, from where, do they go together?
Well, from where I sit, a lot of the new innovation that's coming out is combining the two, is using innovative technologies to grasp and gather ecological reality, really. There's a company that I met that's using a technology very, very similar to how mangroves filter water and clean out water. I mean, it's really very, very interesting. Now, is this already at commercial scale? Not yet, in fact. And in a month, I'll be back in London speaking at a conference that's looking at these new water technologies. That is, as you said, combining both the attention to the environment with the attention to innovation. So I don't think they're completely different.
Okay, and I will a bit later want to come back to you about how do we finance these new technologies.
Sure.
But Jens, it's your turn to open your envelope and let's see what you've got.
What I have in my envelope is WaterWise.
Oh, gosh. Okay. What
does
that mean?
It's nice and fluffy.
Yes, what does that mean?
Well, I think in this case, when it comes to water for energy, or energy for water, rather, I would say, as I mentioned before, one of the things that, maybe it should have been, I thought about it afterwards, maybe it should have been resource-wise, not water-wise, but I'll come back to that maybe later. As I said before, I mean, if you don't, what we put energy into in the water sector is treatment and transport.
Yes.
And unless you have to, if you don't have to treat as much, if you have clean water, if you sort of are able to reuse the water for other purposes without treating it, then that's a good thing. It's also very good if you don't have to transport water, having it nearby or being more efficient. I mean, consumers could be more efficient, industries can be more efficient, and agriculture could be far more efficient. So if you can be more efficient, don't having to treat as or transport as much water, that is a huge gain also in terms of energy. And then there's also another thing. I think there's been a mind shift maybe the past 20 years or so where wastewater was seen as a problem. And now it's more and more being seen as a resource. We're finding new value in this liquid acid stream. So from the wastewater in Stockholm today, the organic content is used to make biogas to run the buses of the city. And hence, that is energy. The heat energy in the water is sort of extracted and put into the district heating system. The nutrients are used, recovered, and put on sort of for growing of energy crops. So there are many things that, and I've actually heard people saying that the sort of water treatment plants are now becoming green factories for energy. They're able to collect fats and other things to make biodiesel. So there's actually energy coming out of the wastewater rather than being sort of a treatment process. So I think this is something we need to be smart about how we use water, and we need to have a long-term perspective to be water-wise.
Okay, thank you. Gerard, coming back to another misconception I may have of the water industry. So one of the things that around the Nexus is that it does demand people to work in new ways and across sectors and across functioning. So we need new ways of looking. And so one of the things Jens mentioned, for instance, was about agricultural waste and how that sort of often will poison water. So how is the water industry working in a sense, upstream. I mean, are you working with, let's say, farmers and the agricultural sector to clean up water at the top end, so actually you don't have to treat it? Where does your responsibilities start and stop?
Well, we have responsibilities, but we are also stakeholders, so we work with others for solving all the water challenges. They are about the quantity, the quality of water, and water management has to be integrated anyway. But it is true that we work a lot with farmers for protecting the quality of the water resources that we use for feeding cities. That's absolutely right. In many areas, we work with farmers in order that the sources are not contaminated by pesticides or excessive nitrates or things like that. This happens everywhere. We have to protect our resources.
But do you think you as an industry should be doing more to actually be more proactive in this? Because most sectors still stick. They might marginally sort of do something outside, but they tend to stick in their silos. And what we need is new thinking. Should you be actually doing far more to actually address issues like this?
Well, yesterday I was in a meeting where we discussed with farmers. I mean, our industry works with all the other water users. But on energy, I'm not so sure. I mean, we work on the contaminants, on the quantities, on the quality of the water, but energy, I'm not so sure.
Okay. Usha, I want to bring you in here, because firstly, on the water industry, do you think actually there needs to be more joined-up thinking, and if so, how? And also, secondly, just going back to an issue we discussed earlier in one of the other sessions about biofuels and subsidies, and whether actually we need to actually change the subsidy system. So just those two aspects.
So on this point, I mean, I think that Gerard is right. I mean, a company should do more than they are doing today, and they should be much more integrated in the way they look at the water resource, which is kind of what he's saying. So the responsibility of a water provider is not just water provision, but securing the water resource and using less resources overall in terms of energy and so on. So I think that should happen. Is it happening yet? Not as much as one would like to see. Yeah. And the time as IFC that we see it happening is when there is a risk event that affects a water provider or a risk event that affects a water polluter. It's only when that kind of thing happens that they realize that in order to be a citizen of the economy, social economy in which they are participating, they need to work together. They need to make sure that the water is not quite as polluted at source so that they don't spend as much of scarce resources in order to deliver it to the end consumer. So that should happen. I must say from where I sit, it's not happening more. My job today is to get companies to think more like that, to think of themselves as parts of a sustainable, closed-loop, circular economy, which is kind of where he was going.
What would that mean in terms of the relationship between water companies and energy companies? So there's one thing about doing upscale, but what is going on in that relationship?
You know, water companies, actually going even more upstream than that, water ministries and power ministries should be talking much more than they are today. And the Water Resources Group, who you may have heard, it's an entity that was set up that's being hosted by IFC right now, is looking at that to get ministries to get out of their silos and start working together to say, if you have a plan of energy enhancement in your country of 80,000 megawatts, this is how much water you're going to need. So let's see if you have that much water. Equally, if you need to deliver to another 20 million people, this is how much energy you're going to need. So it has to start from there. Once it starts from there, then the providers have to be talking to each other as well. And in fact, unfortunately, again, risks are leading the way towards greater collaboration. In my country, in India, several power plants had to be shut down. Coal-fired power plants had to be shut down because there was no water for cool-down systems. And so it's only when something like that happens that the collaboration starts picking up.
Okay. Yes, very briefly, because then I want to move on.
Well, you asked me something about the responsibility of water operators. I would like to mention something downstream. I mean, we have clearly a responsibility to convince people for saving water, that they save water. We did that, and the results are impressive. In Western Europe, water consumption is declining. But with respect to energy consumption, maybe we should do the same. I mean that the energy consumption in the water sector is far higher in the buildings at home than with water companies. More or less, the people use 5 times more energy for heating the water they get from their tap than the energy that is used for bringing their water to them.
Okay, good point. So, and that relates to, because I want to bring in a couple of the Twitter questions here, and one is from Clara Tam, who's contract manager at Veolia Vatan, and she says, how do we increase awareness about consumption of water in relation to energy production, which is your point. Jens, how important is that? Because it's all very well bringing the water, but if then people just waste it and heat it for no reason, then actually that's probably a huge problem, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think I have a good answer. I'm not really aware of the situation in the whole of the world. I think in Sweden, and especially people living in sort of not single house or larger buildings, I've never seen a water bill, for example. Nobody knows how much they pay for the water. It's part of the rent that you pay for the building, for staying there. I think that is one issue, that if you don't see the water, it comes out of your tap. It goes down the drain. The same with food. You get it from the supermarket.
But Jens, whose role is that? Because, you know, when I get my water bill, there might be a little leaflet about saving money, but, you know, I throw it in the bin, as I imagine most people do. I mean, part of the problem is, whose responsibility is it?
To
get consumers, citizens, to actually take this issue seriously and do something about it.
At least you get a water bill. Yeah. Many people don't get water bills.
Yeah. And I think that is a problem. And I think we need to know much more about sort of. I think also water is taken so much for granted. And it's not something, I mean, it wouldn't really affect you. If you save 10 litres or 20 litres or whatever, it wouldn't really make any difference on your water bill. And that is a problem. We don't really value water. We take it for granted. It's something that is there. And the water sector has been very good at providing people with water. So we're so used to having it. Water is only seen when it's a problem. It's never seen for the productive resources it is, for how we use it for our daily lives. We don't understand how much of this is water. Everything we do is water, but we don't see it, and that is a problem. And I don't really have the answer to do that, but I think this is a perfect example. This is what we need to do much more. Talking about water, bringing it out, discussing it, and seeing it's the vital issue for sort of the world we want.
Okay. Usha, I just want to bring back the issue of finance, because I think that's critical, because many of the sustainability challenges are made more difficult because it's very difficult to get the right level of finance to new technologies that might need longer-term financing, might be not yet completely proven. It's much easier for people to invest in old technologies that are proven. But how are we going to change that? Because actually, fundamentally, isn't one of the key issues around finance?
It is, and connected to my issue here, which is delivery finance, is absolutely fundamental. But here's the thing about finance. One can get finance when the financiers know they'll get their money back, quite frankly. That links into what Jens was saying, which is, for me, change in the water sector will come about only when you start talking about water as something that is priced and valued. Once it's priced and valued, that doesn't mean exploitative pricing at all. And there is the need for water as a fundamental human right, which I completely believe in. But you need to consider water as a finite resource and not something that, as you said, runs out of taps and into drains and so on and so forth. Then you start creating a bit of a delivery model around it that can be financed. Without that kind of delivery model, it's very difficult to find lenders or even people to put equity into the water sector, as Gerard might agree with, because it is not something that is revenue generating in any way. And this is and so where we sit from IFC or the World Bank, we talk about cost recovery. There is a cost of delivering water. That means getting it, transporting it, treating it, etc. That cost has to be recovered. Beyond that, you don't actually have to have any sort of profit element to it, but you must recover costs. And this is for the private sector, where Gerard is sitting, but also the public sector, whether it's a public sector provider or a private sector provider, they must be able to recover costs.
Okay, and the reason I mentioned finance, there was a message from Sonal Delai, who's Director of Business and Sustainability Council of Conservation International. She said, what level of financing will be required, and are there innovative financial products that can help with the transition?
The level of financing is enormous. It has been estimated in various reports, and it runs into the hundreds of billions of dollars globally in terms of water delivery. So far, historically, the financing products have been debt and then equity by companies. As we go forward, we are realizing that because the whole valuing water equation hasn't been corrected or put in place yet, there is a need for some sort of innovation in terms of, for example, blended financing. So using subsidies in a clever and smart sort of way to bring down the overall cost of providing water. So there are blended financing products that, for example, IFC is working on to help finance water projects.
Thank you. And Gerard, just from the water company's perspective, because I know that often water companies say, we need to invest, and then the customer said, oh, well, you know, we're not prepared to pay more for that money. You know, we're not prepared to pay more now. How do we get out of that, where actually it's recognised that actually we do need that investment, and actually in the short term you may have to pay higher bills, but actually this is for the longer term? How do we break that short-term, long-term sort of jam?
Well, it's a political issue, so I may not be the right person to answer, but I can provide you my perception anyway. Today, many more people need safe drinking water in the world. Billions of people. So this means a cost. The cost of providing water to people has to be shared. So it can be allocated to the water users or to taxpayers or to a combination. And the mix is a political decision. In some countries, most of the cost is borne by the water users, the case in the UK, for example. In other countries, like in Egypt, most of the cost is borne by the taxpayers. But you have a full range of solutions. All countries have different mixes. That's not the big issue. The main issue is that taxpayers plus water users are in a system where sufficient amounts of money are available for providing the service to everybody. Today, this is not the case. Billions of people, nearly half of mankind, don't have their human right to water satisfied.
And Jens, what's your view on the whole issue of, you know, pricing? So is there a way in terms of encouraging people that, you know, we need to charge much higher prices for people who use high levels of water and actually subsidise those people who are using low level? I mean, are there any innovations we can use in pricing that will actually encourage less water use, which actually then reduces the energy load as well?
Well, yes, of course. There are systems. For example, in South Africa, they have this constitutional right to water. So you have different tiers that after a certain level is free, and above that you have to pay a far higher price. I also think it's interesting this that sort of we talk about the price of water should be set by the cost it takes to sort of treat it and transport it. But I find it interesting now when we talk about energy that a barrel of oil in the ground somewhere, that has a value. But it seems like a barrel of water in the ground somewhere has no value. We don't value it. There's no scarcity value to water. And as water is starting to be, it's a finite resource, and we don't really manage it well. So I'm thinking, I mean, most of the other things in the world are monetized. We sort of value them in terms of the monetary value, but water hasn't got that value. So I think in addition to the cost recovery part, we might also have to sort of look at the issue of putting a scarcity price for water in order to for people to start taking it seriously and to use it efficiently.
Okay, Isha, looking questioning.
I'm looking with approval at Jens, which is that absolutely. Look, I think the only time, though, that you will get a scarcity value for water is when it becomes scarce. That's the unfortunate truth.
But that might be too
and
late.
So, yes, but that is the reality as far as
from an IA.
It's not wise.
it is not at all. Absolutely correct. And I think that people think about water as a finite resource when it is in fact finite. So if you think of Arizona, if you think of California and the United States, you think of parts of India, you think of course, some of the Arab countries. It's a real issue. There, they are trying to find ways to get water to be priced in such a way that less of it is used and that people value it more, so that behavior changes. But if as long as water is considered infinite, and I don't care where it comes from, as long as I have it in my shower, then nobody's going to be willing to pay the prices that are needed to get the finance in to refurbish and renew the sector.
Gerard, just another question that came in online, which said, increasing urbanization means that we have to pump water from further and further away. To what degree is the amount of energy needed to do this a risk for cities as they continue to grow? So, I mean, are we going to get to a crunch point, actually, when cities become so big and water becomes short, which means you have to pump it from even further away, that actually cities might run out of water?
I'm very pleased that somebody asked this question, because urban growth is one of the most difficult challenges for the water sector today. half of the global population lives in cities today, and this is growing. And unfortunately, public water services are outpaced by urban growth. The cost of energy to provide water in cities is increasing for several reasons. Every year, growing cities have to find water farther or deeper, and in most cases, with additional purification treatments. So it requires more energy. And this is why local solutions, when available, are absolutely essential. But anyway, cities are going farther, deeper every year. So this is why I said earlier, unfortunately, there are reasons for the cost of energy to increase in the cost of a cubic meter of water. There is another trend, which is a technological improvement of the cost of the cost of the energy consumption. But in my view, inevitably, the cost of energy in water will increase. In the UK, 8% of the cost of cost of operating water services is for electrical power. But in a city like Dakar, it is 50% already. So energy is very essential for water.
Jens, I just want to ask you, I mean, if, let's say, we just carry on regardless, like Usha says, well, you know, we're not very good at proactively dealing with problems before they hit us. So if, let's say, we wait that long and it hits us, what's the risk in terms of water access, but also the energy needed for water? What's the risk if we don't start to take proactive action?
I don't even want to think about that.
Well,
sorry.
No, I know you don't want to think about it, but I think it's important our audience understand what the risks are.
No, I think, if we continue current trends, there have been estimations by, I think it was the UN who did it, that by 2030, the demand for water would outstrip supply by some 40%. I mean, that cannot happen. And of course, I think that is probably not the situation we'll have, but we'll need to start using water far more efficiently and start thinking more about water. And I think there's a huge mind shift that has to happen. And this year, during the World Water Week, we talked about food, and that has been discussed before. And there were people there saying that you could quite easily increase water efficiency in agriculture by doubling it or tripling it quite easily. And that would not need a lot of infrastructure investment. That could come as a bonus on top of that. But just by sort of getting people trained and better aware of the marketing opportunities, and could increase water efficiency in agriculture enormously. And agriculture is the biggest water user. Yeah. So if we can save water in agriculture, we will have water for the other uses that we want to use water for. But we need to change our mindset, and we need to start valuing water. We need to start looking at the world through a water lens. And that's why I think also I thought about this water-wise that I put there instead of resource-wise. I think one way, since water is connected to so many of the issues that we have to deal with, looking at the world through a water lens will actually show us a lot of the synergies that we can tap into and use to create space for future well-being.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for all your questions through Twitter. We need to start concluding, but Gerard, I just want to start with you. When you look at this whole territory, do you think the biggest leverage of change to actually start
for energy consumption?
Yeah, in terms of the energy for water. I mean, what actually is the biggest impact we can make, and how are we going to get there?
I think there are several tools, and there is no single solution. But you mentioned the water we use. This is something which is very important, because in the future, if we are able to accept that wastewater, urban wastewater, is reused at a larger scale, it will solve problems of quantity of water that is available, because it will make additional resources available for irrigation, for example. And in addition, reusing wastewater requests far less energy than desalinating seawater, which is another option.
And just to ask, what's the problem with reusing water in cities? Is that a cultural thing, a health thing? What is it?
It is mainly cultural. Yes, absolutely. Well, there are technical issues. How should I say that? In order to reuse urban wastewater, you have to make sure that there is no toxic going into the wastewater. So you have to control the pollution upstream, which is possible. This is organized in many cities, but it requires some will. So you have to do something. But in several countries, wastewater reuse is handicapped because the people don't understand why we should do that.
Okay.
Although it is really a very good solution to many problems.
Okay, Usha, what would you say? I mean, when you again looking at the whole territory, where can we get some movement? Is it around education? Is it around technology? Is it around finance? Where do you think the key levers of change are?
I actually think it's behavior, number one. So efficiency is going to be a much shorter term route to using less energy, less water, and therefore less energy. But the second one is technology. Yep, for me, that's for me the big new frontier. Whether it's using different sources of energy, which are lower cost, you know, which because when we talk about use of energy, we typically think of fossil fuel based energy. But countries that are looking at solar energy, for example, to treat water and so on and so forth. Qatar is making a big deal of looking at solar desalination even. And if you can bring that cost down, that's the other frontier to solving this nexus.
And yes, do you have faith in technology or actually is it behavior change or is it actually we need to do everything at the same time?
Unfortunately, I think we need to do everything at the same time. I think the collaboration is the key issue here. We need all the different stakeholders and partners coming together and discussing this. I don't see 100% solution. I see hundreds of 1% solutions, and they need to fit together into a system. And hence, we need to work together, all the different. We need the private sector, we need the financiers, we need the NGOs, we need media. All of us need to work on this together.
So again, that's great in principle. Everyone works together, but traditionally, everyone's been very separate and sometimes in competition with each other.
Absolutely.
How are we going to convince people to actually do work together? What's the process?
Well, there are two ways. One is like this, having a debate and discussion, meeting and talking to each other and sort of seeing the world through each other's eyes, so to say. The other thing is that if we don't do anything about water, water has an uncanny ability to make itself reminded if we forget it. Unfortunately, in very bad things happen. So if we don't do things right, will be in very dire straits in the future. And that realization will come. When it comes now, or in a couple of years, or too late, that I think is the burning issue.
And Usha, when are we going to hit that crunch point?
I think we've hit it. I think there's a lot of awareness that it can't be business as usual anymore, and that we do have to do things differently in the future. Policymakers are realizing this. Consumers even are realizing this. The trajectory of change is a little bit slower than I'm comfortable with, that's all. And the only way you can make that faster is by a negative event, unfortunately, happening. That's
the reality.
That's the reality of where we are.
Okay.
I hope not.
Okay. Thank you very much to the panel. Gerard Payan, Usha Romanari, hopefully that's correct, and Jens Beglen. So thank you very much. My name is Joe Confino. I really appreciate the fact that you've been with us today. Hope you've learned a lot, and goodbye.
This debate and the other debates in the series are available to watch in video form on the Guardian Sustainable Business site. That's guardian.co.uk/sustainable-business. Remember, for breaking science news, day and night, just go to guardian.co.uk/science. This podcast was produced by me, Jason Phipps. Till next week, goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.